Welcome to Ideas. I'm Paul Kennedy. Today, we're at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts on the campus of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. It's mid-April. More than 1,000 people are here to listen to the Canadian writer and thinker, John Ralston Saul. He's going to talk about an idea from his most recent book, A Fair Country, Telling Truths About Canada. The idea is this. John Ralston Saul calls Canada a Métis nation. He says that most of us believe our country's values and ideas have European roots, but we're wrong. At their core, he says, Canada's deepest values are Aboriginal. John Ralston Saul will argue his case today in the 2009 Laurier Institution UBC Multiculturalism Lecture. Here to introduce him is Sean Atleo, Hereditary Chief of the Ahuset First Nation and British Columbia Regional Chief for the Assembly of First Nations.
Mr. Ralston Saul, as you all know, is an award-winning essayist and novelist, and he's had a growing impact on political and economic thought, not just here in Canada, but in many countries. We know of his contributions and of his thoughts on topics like individualism, citizenship, and the public good. The confusion, as it were, between notions of leadership and managerialism. He is also included in the prestigious Utney Readership List, the Reader's List of the world's 100 leading thinkers and visionaries. He's received many national and international awards. I want to point out that he's co-chair of the Institute for Canadian Citizenship. He's a companion in the Order of Canada in 1999, and he's received 14 honorary degrees. I believe that we have arrived here an evening together to listen to a man who is helping to encapsulate a moment in the history of this country, a moment in time where there is an excitement about a reflection about this country and about its relationships. And we as Indigenous people are looking to British Columbians, we're looking to Canadians, and we're looking to thinkers like Mr. John Ralston Saul to do exactly what I believe he has come here to do and what he's done by authoring and sharing with us this generous gift of his thoughts in this book, and that's to expand the conversation so that we might revisit the relationships of one another in this great land. So ladies and gentlemen, fellow fans of John Ralston Saul, please join me in offering a warm welcome and an expression of thanks and appreciation. Let's ask John Ralston Saul to offer his thoughts here this evening.
I'm grateful to the Musqueam First Nation for their hospitality on this, their traditional, ancestral, and unceded land. It's wonderful to be speaking here again on your land. Canada was built out of a conversation. We have, you know, bad moments in our history, and some of them went on rather a long time, like 100 years. But you have to take that sense of history. You have to have the determination and patience that the Aboriginal peoples have shown to understand what time is about and how time works. Canada was built out of a conversation between, in the beginning, the First Nations and the newcomers, the immigrants. Champlain, immigrant. And to that conversation was added, through that conversation, in fact, between First Nations and immigrants, to that conversation was added the Métis people, out of the conversation, and then were added the Inuit people. And I spent a lot of time in the North with the Inuit people who are very much involved in that conversation. And it's not talked about that much in the South, but they're at the center of the conversation. This is the basic Canadian conversation. Countries are built on conversations. You know, there are people who think that countries are built on, I don't know, management schools or theories of economic efficiency or whatever. Well, those are all very well, but countries are built on conversations. They're built on ideas. They're built on relationships. And those conversations create the structure of the civilization, of our civilization, both in its overarching sense and in all its details of the different parts of it. And that conversation has gone on for a very long time. I'm, as many of you know, driven to distraction when our political leaders get up and read speeches written for them by speechwriters who pull them off their computers, thereby repeating again and again that we're a new country, that we're a new country. Really, it's funny how you could be a new country when the founding people have been here forever, for thousands of years. I don't know what's so new about that. And I don't know what's new about 400 years, if you look at the country in terms of its latest expression since the arrival of the immigrants and the beginning of that conversation between Aboriginals and new Canadians. 400 years, it's a long time, a very long time. And inside of that, we're now the oldest continuous democratic federation in the world. I'm going to repeat, you know, the oldest continuous democratic federation in the world. We've been around a long time in various ways, getting it right and getting it wrong, and everything in between, of course. And it's really very simple what I'm saying in this book and in these talks as I go around the country. And this is a very different talk tonight because of the way that we're structuring it around the multiculturalism lecture. It's very simple. In its current manifestation, we've been at this for almost exactly 400 years. And for the first 250 of those 400 years, you know, this is in history, you have to pick a date, right? Of course, it's completely untrue because depending on where you are in the country, it could be the first 280 years or the first 220, or if you're up in the Arctic, it's the first 330 years. But let's take an average and say, for the first 250 years of the 400, Aboriginal peoples were the dominant people in the conversation, or were equal partners. Again, it depends on where you were and what the circumstances were. And for those first 250 years, the conversation was an unbroken conversation between Aboriginal peoples and wave after wave of newcomers, French, Scots, Loyalists, an expanding variety of people from all over the world. And I just say in passing that when I say Loyalists, we were mostly taught at school that Loyalists were sort of these anti-democratic, anti-individualistic, upper-middle-class English Americans who came here to escape the, I don't know, the filth of individualism and democracy in the United States. And that became the excuse for thinking of Canada as a place of peace, order, and good government and nonsense like that. Whereas, of course, any analysis of the Loyalists shows that the largest group in the Loyalists were German religious minorities. The second and third were Irish and Scottish Catholics who were in North America because they really had been thumped so badly by the English, and so they weren't exactly pro-English. And the fourth and fifth groups were, of course, Aboriginal coming up, Joseph Brant and so on, and Black Loyalists. There were more Black Loyalists than there were English in the Loyalists. Just worth saying that on the way by, because it changes radically the way you think about those Loyalists. Most of them came from the northern fringes of the American colonies, where in fact where there were more likely to be minorities away from the majority English people in the colonies. There was this American-British civil war between the English that led to the United States. So these other people were living up on the fringes, and it was there they lived very often with, in close contact with, working with First Nations people and Métis people. So it was in a way that the Loyalist group was almost like a typical prototype of Canada. But all through that period, 250, 300 years, there were approximately 2 million Aboriginal people in Canada. And they were dealing with a few hundred Europeans, which became a few thousand and a few tens of thousands. So in other words, for this entire period of time in which the conversation was set in the country, not only were the Aboriginal peoples the dominant people, not only were their ideas and their methods the dominant thing, but their numbers were so incredibly dominant vis-a-vis the small, fragile minority of immigrants who were, for a very long period of time, and it went on for a long period of time, hanging on. Just hanging on, and in general hanging on, thanks to a great extent to the conversation with Aboriginal peoples. And it wasn't simply that Aboriginals were dominant in numbers and in ways of getting food and, you know, utilitarian things. They were dominant, yes, in numbers, yes, by methodology, yes, by comfort, but yes, in ideas. And that, perhaps, is the thing which has not been said by non-Aboriginals at all. So in this conversation, a lot of it was about the newcomers, the immigrants, adapting largely to Aboriginal ways. Of course, Aboriginals also adapted to European ways. But that, of course, has been overstated radically because of who wrote the histories. You know, the written cultures versus the oral cultures. So they wrote it, it is as if, you know, having the wheel was the most wonderful thing. Well, of course, the first thing the Europeans dropped when they came to Canada was the wheel, for a very simple reason. The wheel breaks in the Canadian Shield. And the second thing they did was to adapt to the modern efficient means of communication in place, which was the canoe, and for about 250 years it was the dominant means. And this is the only imperial experiment of Europe in which the Europeans actually built their part of the civilization by using almost entirely the locals, I'm being ironic, the Aboriginals' means of communication, suggesting that it was the modern and the superior method. So they adapted to all of that, but they adapted to the ideas. Yes, of course, there were European ideas, and they're written about endlessly. But what isn't written about is the extent to which the Europeans actually adapted to the ideas that they found here, because that was part of figuring out how to live here. Those ideas. Ideas are not abstract in the sense of being disembodied. They may be abstract, but they're embodied, and they are of a place. And I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. So what was interesting about that conversation was that it was almost entirely oral. It was oral because First Nation civilizations belonged to the oral tradition. And the newcomers, the immigrants, were largely out of an oral tradition. A few of them used the written word, but they were basically oral. And the only way in which they could talk to each other was oral in any case, but they talked among themselves, the Europeans, in an oral manner, not in a written manner. It wasn't a managerial society. It wasn't a European written society. It was an oral society here. And then the Métis people were largely oral. And wave after wave of immigrants that followed continued to be oral, either because they came from the oral tradition or because they spoke neither English nor French or any of the Aboriginal languages, and therefore the only way in which they could communicate was not certainly through the written word, but in a sense through indirection and the oral word. And often that went on for two or three generations, that orality. Even today, when you look at Canada, and we take 1% of our population a year in immigrants, 85% become citizens within 5 years. That's just to be clear about. There's nowhere else in the world that has numbers like this. 85% become citizens within 5 years. In the United States, it's 40%. And in Europe, they're having a heart attack over 5 or 6%. So we're talking, you know, one has to focus on the numbers from time to time, particularly when they're so clear. So the conversation has remained incredibly oral. This is a very oral country. It remains a very oral country. Our written literature is very oral in its style. Our poetry is very oral in its style. Now, at the same time, there were governors, there were bosses who were writing back to the people at home in London or Paris, reporting on how well they were doing in the colonies, how dominant they were, how they were in charge, how everybody was doing what they wanted. It's a very interesting problem for a university. We're in the middle of a university, which is, of course, universities are built on analyzing the written word. But the written word is far easier to use for lying than orality. Orality is based on shared memory, which means a whole bunch of people are part of the memory. Whereas one person can sit down and actually write a lie and make it sound like the truth and get away with it, actually. And so the whole formal history of Canada continues to be written on the basis of an analysis of texts, which in the 17th and 18th and the 19th century were largely lies, because they were either reports from here back to Europe, in which Champlain was writing one thing and doing something completely different, the people from the Hudson's Bay Company were writing one thing and doing something completely different, and so on and so on and so on. And of course, part of that written lie, as we know, was the way in which the treaties were explained orally to oral civilizations, but actually treated in a completely different way through the written civilizations. Fortunately, our Supreme Court in the last 15 years has looked at the oral and said the oral is true and the written's a lie, facts are a lie, so we're going with the oral. That's what Delgamut's about, and that's what a number of the other decisions are about. A revolutionary decision in a quote-unquote Western civilization, that the Supreme Court would decide that oral memory was not only more accurate but more important than written memory. Fascinating. And, of course, very little has been done with it because it so terrifies the legal profession. And in that period, in that process, I spoke about, you know, the creation of the Métis people, one of the most remarkable things to happen in this country, one of the most exciting things to happen in this country. And, you know, what was really happening there? Very simple. Take the example of the young Scottish guys who would come and work for the Hudson's Bay Company. So here you have some poverty-stricken, really quite poor young Scottish men. English is their second language because, you know, they've been thumped by the English and they're forced to speak it in order to do their job. They don't really have much of an education. They don't own much. They haven't got much of a future. They get a job to come and be an assistant factor of the Hudson's Bay Company or whatever. And they have an unwritten instruction that as soon as they get here, they're to try and negotiate marriages with daughters of chiefs. Why? Well, it's very simple. They're poor young men with nothing. And if they can negotiate one of these marriages, they'll marry a young woman who will make sure that they eat all right, so they'll eat better. They won't eat the wrong food in the winter, so they won't die of scurvy. They'll dress properly. They'll live in decent housing. And on top of that, they'll marry into an alliance which is both an economic trade alliance and a military alliance. Now, in European terms, that's what's called marrying up. Right? It's important to understand. It's wonderfully funny because, of course, your laughter tells you exactly how wrong our history is, how our history is taught backwards from a European point of view. They were marrying up. They were doing very well by marrying Aboriginal. And once you think about your country in that way, you begin to understand not simply the power structures, but the intellectual structures, the idea structures, the conversation in a totally different way. I've had a number of evenings where I say something like this, and at the end somebody comes up to me and says, "You're absolutely right. People should talk and write more about Samuel de Champlain." What do you mean? Well, of course, what they mean is that I'm absolutely right to say important things about Aboriginal peoples, providing that it's said through a European point of view. And that shows you the extent to which our history has been deformed so that we're not able to see ourselves the way we really are.
I'm Paul Kennedy. You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1. Across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137 and around the world on cbc.ca. Today we're at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts on the campus of the University of British Columbia. The Canadian writer and thinker John Ralston Saul is delivering the 2009 Laurier Institution UBC Multiculturalism Lecture. John Ralston Saul says that we have our history backwards. We usually think that Canada was shaped by values and ideas that came from Europe. Not so, he argues. We're more Aboriginal. 400 years of contact with Aboriginal people have done more to shape us than anything else. He describes Canada as a Métis nation. He calls his talk Aboriginals and New Canadians. The missing conversation.
But then, after those first 250 years, for a whole series of reasons, and I'm not going to keep you here all night, so I'm going to do some quick leaps here and there, but you know the answers to these things. There was a collapse. There was a collapse in the Aboriginal populations caused by a whole series of things, disease being one of the main things, but there were many other factors. And it went from 2 million to about 175,000. One of the most astonishing collapses in population, which led, of course, the incredibly fast, by that point, growing immigrant population to say, well, they're done, so let's help them along the way, you know, with residential schools and so on. Make them disappear, and we'll do it for their own good. It's amazing how people who are looking after themselves can feel good about doing things for other people, which isn't to the advantage of the other people, if they just get the sentence right, you know? And the most difficult part of what was happening was that inside that rise in immigration were people like me, which is to say Northern Irish Protestants and English, who came in very large numbers at the time that empires were worshipped. Empires ran the world, the British, the French, and so on. And very aggressively, particularly the Northern Irish Protestants, brought the message that they were in charge because the empire was in charge, and they were going to go a certain way. And we saw the country move out of its real conversation into a kind of dissonance, into an atonal, false conversation, a rewriting of our history, a wiping out, a whitewashing of the whole preceding 250 years. Aboriginal peoples, First Nations, Métis, and already to some extent Inuit, erased from the central memory of the country, turned into sort of bystanders or helpers or whatever, but taken out of the center. And it was a very precise and vicious application of both political methodology, educational methodology, and intellectual methodology. And it was applied in different places, in different ways, so that they could be sure it would work. It was applied slightly differently to First Nations and to Métis, and so on. And it was, because that was the period of the rise of racism coming out of the European idea of the nations, of the monolithic nation state, that was the period that saw also the rise of other racisms, the head tax, what was done to the Japanese a bit later, the rise of anti-Semitism. It was, to put it mildly, a bad 100 years. But even in the midst of all of that, what I think is fascinating, in the midst of this betrayal, Aboriginal peoples persisted in attempting to have a conversation. And I just quote from the famous memorandum of the BC chiefs presented in person by them to Wilfrid Laurier when he was Prime Minister in 1910 on his visit to Kamloops. And they were speaking, this quote, they were speaking about their attempts in the second half of the 19th century, some years before. These people, the immigrants, wish to be partners with us in our country. We must therefore be the same as brothers to them and live as one family. What is ours will be theirs, and what is theirs will be ours. We will help each other to be great and good. What an amazing elegance. What amazing sophistication, intellectual sophistication. What a concentrated sense of an idea of how a civilization, an immigrant civilization, a non-monolithic civilization, a civilization with Aboriginal peoples as the founding pillar, amazingly sophisticated idea of how that could work. A stepping away from the idea of absolute ownership, which was, of course, the European idea of it was yours, now it's mine, you know, and there's nothing in between those two absolutes. Well, as we know, after 1945, there was a gradual removal of these various racisms, particularly as regards new Canadians, immigrants, who were not so new, many of them by that point. And as that was removed, we began to see ourselves increasingly and healthily as, in good part, an immigrant society. And we began to admire that, and then we began to enjoy it. But the blockage against Aboriginal peoples remained to a great extent. There was a gradual comeback, but it was much tougher than for the immigrant population. And yet, in the 1970s, when it was still very tough, there was Grand Chief John Kelly saying, as the years go by, the circle of the Ojibwe gets bigger and bigger. Canadians of all colors and religions are entering that circle. You might feel that you have roots somewhere else, but in reality, you are right here with us. Now, I think one could say that the whole conversation, the original conversation, is at least in part restored, in part. And I think the chief, what he was talking about, this is one of those moments when we move from one age to another age. A great deal of it is restored, a lot of it unconsciously. But if you look at our novels and you look at our plays and you look at our poetry written by First Nations, Métis, Inuit, immigrants who come here from any time, in any time over the last 400 years, and you see the shape they're taking. Increasingly, there's a consciousness in them of the original conversation and that it's still the real conversation of Canada. But there's also, even in people who've never thought about that conversation, who were never educated about that conversation, who don't know anything about the shape and the reality of the conversation and live somewhere, I don't know, in Toronto and think they've never met an Aboriginal person and don't know anything about it. In spite of that, you read their novels and there's a sense within them of the reality of that conversation, even though they wouldn't be able to explain in a kind of abstract intellectual way, that that's what they were doing. But that's because the conversation is so real. That's because it is so deep in the collective unconscious of this civilization. But on the other hand, if you look at the political area, most of mainstream education at all levels, most of architecture, all of management, a good deal of business, it's all in denial of this conversation. They not only believe, but increasingly want to believe, that our main conversation is with the Euro-US Western tradition. They hide behind phrases like globalism, but what they're actually talking about is New York, maybe California, with occasional holidays in various parts of Western Europe. That's what they mean by globalization. They see themselves as primarily being temporarily here, maybe a couple of hundred years, but they're keeping their options open because their principal conversation is with this outside world that they would call Western civilization, of which they see themselves in some way as minor players. And they hope that if they could just make a breakthrough somewhere out there, they would be a little more than minor players. This is false internationalism. And of course, it means that they are out of touch with their own civilization. In the universities and the schools, we continue to teach English literature in literally a virtual reconstruction of the British Empire. You know, start with the Bible translated into English and the Book of Common Prayer, and you come through Shakespeare, and you work your way down, and you end up in a university in Canada. And it's all a straight line. The only way to study it is to go backwards, up that line. Philosophy continues to be taught as if we didn't exist, you know. Athens, Rome, then Rome again, you know, and then you zip over maybe to Germany so you can get a bit of Immanuel Kant, and then from there you rush over either to Oxbridge or to Paris, and from there you come to Canada, and nothing happens here. 400 years, nothing happens. You write philosophy, you write about your relationship to Immanuel Kant. I'm not saying he's dumb. But is that the only real relationship? Have we been doing nothing here for 400 years? Did nothing happen here for the couple of thousand years preceding that? You see exactly how silly this is when you look at something like the environment. You know, Canada in many ways is way ahead. The way we talk about it, we've produced a lot of the environmental leaders of the environment movement in the world, Suzuki, Boris Strong, Greenpeace, and so on. But what we do is among the worst. And one of the reasons we're so disconnected between what we think and what we do is because we base our environmental ideas on something that comes out of elsewhere, out of European philosophy. So our ideas about nature in the philosophy world are based on what? Jean-Jacques Rousseau? Thoreau, you know, a kind of romantic, pastoral version of collecting grapes as you walk along a path. Or in the case of Rousseau, you have lunch with your mistress in a nice little chateau in the mountains, and you go out for a walk in the park where the trees are all in nice lines and there are no black flies, there are no mosquitoes. There are probably servants to kill them if there were any. And out of that romantic idea come the roots of the ideas of environmentalism, which we're struggling with here, which make absolutely no sense here at all. So as we develop, our elites become more and more out of step with our reality. It's as if they're trying to govern another place, a place we're not. They have a written, disembodied idea of Canada that comes with the peace, order, and good government version of Canada, the family compact version of Canada, linear, monolithic, orderly, colonial people, a sort of view of ourselves made up in the late 19th century, the after effects of empire worship, The reality, of course, is that from the Royal Proclamation in 1763 and the Quebec Act in 1774, the motto of Canada was peace, welfare, and good government, which meant, of course, welfare, fare ye well, fairness, inclusion, egalitarianism. A peaceful, fair, and well-governed country, an idea of inclusion. And it was only changed in 1867 in our Constitution because we agreed that we would pay for our defense, and by paying for our defense, we became independent, and the word order was put in to show that we were paying for our defense. And that peace, welfare, and good government ran parallel to Aboriginal ideas, such as the idea of the great bowl and spoon, which is one of the most important philosophical ideas in this country, which is why it's never taught. And is known by very, very few people, but explains why the country works at its best the way it works. And so when you think about, well, what are the foundations, the legal foundations of this country? Well, the legal foundations are the Great Peace of Montreal, 1701, and the Treaty of Niagara, 1764. Both treaties written, yes, but written, if you like, dictated according to an Aboriginal way of imagining the country, not a European way of imagining the country. It's an Aboriginal philosophy, those two treaties. And the confusion we have today is because most of this is forgotten, except among specialists. So that, for example, when we use words like sovereignty or self-government in Canada, both when it's in conversations with Aboriginal peoples or with Quebecers, immediately, intellectually, we think of those words in their European sense. We think of them in the way European philosophers and political scientists would think of them. Whereas, in fact, to a great extent, they should be understood in a way that First Nations people or Métis people would understand them. Not the European linear idea of ownership, but I don't know, for example, Sakish Henderson, the great First Nations legal philosopher who's in Regina, talks often about the Mohawk definition of sovereignty as harmony achieved through balanced relationships. And Jean Taye, the great Métis legal expert, talks about the necessity to move away today, to move away from the absolute European ideas of monolithic ownership. And the Supreme Court is in agreement with the Aboriginals on this point. But our universities, our intellectual world, has not caught up with this reality of the country. Delgamut, Guérin, Pauly, Williams. Not only is the legal community blocked, but the whole leadership is blocked intellectually on these sorts of questions. The government goes on as if these things hadn't happened. And yet most really serious legal historians or philosophers of law in Canada agree that both the common law and the civil code, le code civil, has, even though they're called common law and code civil, if you actually look at their roots in Canada were reformed in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century by concepts, Aboriginal concepts. They say that. You don't hear it because it's not put through to you. But it said, you go and ask them. I went and asked them. One after another, they said, oh, no, the roots of common law and civil code in Canada are radically different than elsewhere because of the way in which Aboriginal ideas were taken into the roots and changed the roots of them, changed the concepts. There is a conversation which is possible. This is the conversation which will form the relationships which are here in Canada, but unformed intellectually. We want it to work, but we don't know how to describe the way to make it work. So, you know, for example, half Aboriginal population is now in cities. Aboriginal youth are in the cities. New Canadians are in the cities. And yet there's almost no structure to bring those two groups together. They have a great deal to say to each other. They are reinventing the cities, both the new Canadians and the young Aboriginals. They're reinventing the cities, and we're not having any kind of serious conversation about that reinvention. And on top of that, it has to be said that new Canadians, the immigrants and new Canadians, are interested and ready for that conversation. They arrive here very conscious, highly conscious. Remember, immigrants are people who've already proved their consciousness and their courage. They made a decision to change countries, and they had the courage to do it, whatever the reason. Someone like me, I was born here. It didn't take any courage to be a Canadian, right? So it didn't even take consciousness. I can be half asleep and still be a Canadian. I can be three-quarters asleep and still be a Canadian. So new Canadians are ready for this kind of conversation. I've talked to them about it endlessly. And they know that when they become citizens, they inherit the full history of Canada. They are responsible for everything we got right and everything we got wrong. And we're lucky because having so many new Canadians, they will bring with them perhaps new ideas about how we can deal with what we got wrong. They can help us reinvent the way in which we're going to live in our cities. But they need to be helped down that road. They need to be helped into that conversation. And I think that that can be done. So let me just very quickly say, well, talk about these roots of the Canadian imagination, of the Canadian idea. What are they? Well, here we are, a country that worships complexity. We love the idea of living with complexity, of living with difference, of living with cultural differences. Terrifies our friends in the Western world. Dr. Richard Atleo, the father of the chief who introduced me, wrote a very fine book about the theory of Tsawwaq, or Heshuk Ish Tsawwaq. How did I do? It's all right. Which means everything is one. We are a complexity in which we and place fit together. These are very interesting intellectual ideas. The whole concept of the Métis people is a concept of living in complexity, the exact opposite of the European U.S. idea of the melting pot. Secondly, we're a nation built as a non-monolithic nation. Where did this come from, if not out of those 17th, 18th, early 19th century experiences in which the newcomers saw the way in which First Nations people lived, if you like, in a civilization of minorities, separate and overlapping, a multiple personality order. This is a little detail, I always worry a bit about the word multiculturalism because it sounds vaguely Austro-Hungarian. You know, vaguely, you know, groups side by side who are only linked by the fact that there's an emperor to protect them, which isn't, of course, true about Canada. In French, in Canada, they use a term which is interculturalism, interculturalism, which I actually think is a much better word. And I actually say, and will, if I repeat it tonight, say interculturalism. It's not quite right, but it comes a hell of a lot closer to the way in which it worked before the Europeans arrived and the way it arrived and the way it really works today than multiculturalism does. Third, we're a nation which just adores negotiation. We just endlessly negotiate anything. And we never finish our negotiations. We're still negotiating our constitution. It's part of our life. Where does it come from? Why don't we just, like good, decent Westerners, have a war and get it over with? You know, kill some people, get on with it. If you actually analyze Western First Nation and Aboriginal philosophy, you'll find that it's about you keep talking, you keep negotiating. All of our treaties are not, as the Supreme Court has agreed, they're not about we've signed a treaty, it's over. All the chiefs kept saying, what we're doing here is we're working out a relationship for this year, and we'll be back next year to talk about where it goes next. And that idea that complexity, non-monolithic, negotiation, Clément Chartier, the head of the Métis for Canada, says litigation or negotiation, we've always wanted the latter. It's always been the Aboriginal position, and it's actually always been the Canadian position when we're honest with ourselves. Fourth, this is a country which adores balancing an absolute protection of individual rights with an absolute protection of group rights. And then we just sort of work it out. Where did that come from? That's not European. It's the exact opposite of European or of the US. That's an Aboriginal idea. The whole concept of our Constitution and Charter of Rights is based on an Aboriginal idea of balancing absolute protection for individuals with absolute protection for groups and then working it out. There's no explanation as how you're supposed to do that in the Constitution.
You're listening to the 2009 Laurier Institution UBC Multiculturalism Lecture by John Ralston Saul. He's speaking at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts at the University of British Columbia. I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas, in Canada on CBC Radio 1, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, and around the world on cbc.ca. John Ralston Saul is talking about Aboriginals and new Canadians, and what he calls the missing conversation. He says that Aboriginal peoples, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit, have been erased from the central memory of the country and turned into bystanders. And he says, in his words, that it was a very precise and vicious application of political methodology, educational methodology, and intellectual methodology. Here he is with the concluding part of his talk.
We're a civilization which works on the basis of the circle, the great circle, and not the line, which is the US-European idea of the linear rational line, where you go down this line and it's called progress, no matter what happens, and you resolve problems and keep moving. We work within the circle. Where does that idea come from? We all know, even if we don't know that phrase, that we work within the concept of the circle. You know where that comes from. And it's when you say, how is it that Canada is able to take 1% of its population a year in immigration and 85% become citizens, and it sort of works? I know lots of things are wrong and lots of things need to be changed, but it basically works. How are we able to do that? Where does that come from? What is the philosophical theory that makes it work? Well, the answer quite simply is that our friends in the West have concepts, intellectual abstract concepts of citizenship, which are based fundamentally on race, and therefore are based on the necessity of assimilation, because otherwise you can't deal with the racial question. How do we do it? Well, it looks a bit shambolic, but basically it's adoption. It's an adoption system. And where does that adoption system come from? It's Aboriginal. When Champlain arrived, essentially they were adopted into circles. And once you get inside the circles where there are some rules, it's worked out what your role will be and what role you will play. And that's a very important thing to understand, that difference between adoption versus assimilation. Sixth, the oral, an oral civilization, which I've already spoken about, so I don't need to go on about it. So what does all this mean? What it means, first of all, is that we are wasting our time, and when I say our time, I mean the time of Aboriginal leaders and government bureaucrats and taxpayers' money, sending endless lawyers into endless lawsuits to try to pretend that the source of legitimacy in Canada is not Aboriginal. And then they lose, and they just keep sending the lawyers in. Lawsuits that could be dealt with in 3 years take 30 years. They say they're saving taxpayers' money. I don't know how they do their math. They could settle almost every claim for double the amount demanded, and it would be a saving to the taxpayers. And it would be probably a good thing because it would be shifting money in the right directions. Sakish Henderson, again, says a very wise and witty thing. He's quite a dangerous guy, which is good in a philosopher. He says, you know, the source of Canadian legitimacy is the original holders of the land. So to the extent that you go to court to undermine the legitimacy of the original holders of the land, you're undermining yourself. Because if they're not legitimate, you sure aren't legitimate. So I guess someone other country must be. You know, it doesn't make any sense. Second, when these negotiations are satisfactory, when they're satisfactorily completed, Aboriginal people in general will tend to say that they have now negotiated their way into Canada. Chief Joseph Gosnell said that. The Inuit of Nunavut said that. You say, well, there's such a difficult relationship. Well, get over the nuts and bolts. Finish the negotiation in a way that Aboriginal peoples will be satisfied, that they have been properly respected, and probably, I can't speak for them, nor would I try, probably many of them will say that they have now negotiated their way into Canada, and then we can get on with doing something else, like building the conversation that's 400 years old, and in that sense building the great country, as the chief said. Third, Canada is built on three founding pillars, a great building on three founding pillars: Aboriginal, Francophone, and Anglophone, and it is cemented together, if you like, by the Métis people. In a way, that complexity of the Métis people is the cement that holds the foundations together. And then, floor after floor after floor after floor over the years, of new Canadians have arrived, and those floors have been built one on top of the other. It's not that anybody anywhere in the building is more important than anybody else. It's about the architecture of the building, which is quite a different matter. It isn't about who has the most population. It isn't about who's the richest. It's about the architecture of the building. And it's very simple in architecture. If one of the three pillars is weak, the building will fall over. And that's why we spent so much of the last 50 years putting time, money, and policies into strengthening the Francophone pillar, and did a pretty good job. It's not simple. It's not over. But we have not done that, all of us as Canadians, with the Francophone pillar. It needs to be as strong as the other two. The stronger the Aboriginal pillar in this country, the stronger all of us will be. And And the fact is that the Aboriginal peoples have carried their part of the bargain. They have worked themselves back from 175,000 to 1.2 million. They're on their way to 1.3, 1.4. They're on their way to 2 million, where we started. I hope they're on their way to 5 million. There can't be enough Aboriginals in this country, frankly. And when you hear the elites saying, oh my God, those large families, oh my God, those problems, what they're talking about is the fact that they have not yet got out of the 19th century. They still don't understand that you just have to put the education and other programs or the money for those programs in place. They did it for everybody else. So why wouldn't you want to do it for the founding people of this Canada country? And then finally, Canada has two national international languages, but it also has 53 Canadian languages. Most of them are in danger. The federal government's position is that it doesn't subsidize languages other than the two official national languages. I understand that, except in the case of Aboriginal languages, they are the Canadian languages. And it isn't about whether I speak them, or you speak them, or you speak them. It's about the fact that these 53 languages are the secret passage that we have into the deepest collective unconscious of the northern half of North America. And every time the door slams in one of those languages, somebody who, for example, has arrived yesterday as an immigrant from Italy or India, they lose access. Even if it's indirect, they lose the possibility of access to that part of the collective unconscious of the country which they have decided to join. So we have everything to gain by putting the money and the efforts to help people build those languages back up. We have everything as Canadians to gain by not losing those languages. To lose one is a tragic loss. So let me just conclude this by saying this. Northrop Frye, another wickedly funny man, he didn't look it but he was, said this: symmetry in a narrative, in a conversation, in a narrative, symmetry in a narrative always means that historical context is being subordinated to mythical demands of design and form. In other words, if the story is reassuring and smooth and agreeable, it's probably a lie. And what I've been saying to you tonight, and I'm not alone in this, many Aboriginal leaders have been saying a great deal more than I'm saying, and other people are saying this. What I've been saying tonight is not reassuring. It isn't smooth. It has no symmetry. It is, I hope, disturbing to what most of us were taught in our schools, disturbing to what we hear every day, disturbing to our standard version of ourselves. And so what I've been trying to do in a talk like this, in A Fair Country, I'm trying to apply paint remover to peel away the false and smooth myths of the late 19th century, the things that were put in place by that pro-empire group of people. And the reaction that I've heard now in dozens of halls like this, you know, with over 1,000 people, dozens of halls like this across the country, tens of thousands of people, is that these arguments seem to act like a mechanism which they feel releases us from our emotional prison of false memory. They're the sort of arguments, and as I say, many of them are not mine. I don't own them. These sort of arguments allow us to think about ourselves differently, to think about ourselves perhaps as we really are, or as we want to be, or as we want to imagine ourselves. Now that is not bad. If we want to imagine ourselves in this way, it must be because it reflects our unconscious sense of our real selves. It reflects our real memory of ourselves, even if we don't have the intellectual training from our schools to put it together. And if so, if I suggest that we're a country of Aboriginal inspiration, in which the Métis people are the model of our complexity, if I say that our best idea of place is that of Wetaskiwin, living together on the land, a Cree idea of people not above the land, but in the land, that our idea of relationships could be described as Heshuk Ish Tsawak, everything is one, complex interrelationships, that the basis of our relationship as citizens is that we all eat from the great bowl, an idea of community, not an idea of charity, that our motto is peace, fairness, and good government, which runs parallel to these Aboriginal concepts. That by sovereignty, We mean harmony achieved through balanced relationships. That we were always intentionally a non-monolithic civilization, the opposite of the Western tradition. That we like the tension between individuals and the group. That complex and constant negotiations are our idea of fun. That we function best in the concept of the circle. That our idea of immigration and citizenship is one of adoption and not of assimilation. That the Canadian conversation is not written ideology, but just that, a conversation, oral. If I say all of this, and perhaps more, the image which emerges, the image of ourself which emerges, is quite different from the confused, troubled, monolithic, false myth of Canada as the child of Europe. And frankly, it's a hell of a lot more interesting. The most common reactions I hear to these arguments is that people have always thought this. It's a thing you learn as a writer. You go around the country, and if you hear one person say a sentence, and then you're in another province, and somebody else says the same sentence, and you hear it again, and you hear it again, and you hear it again, that means you've tapped into something that's very real, what I would call the collective unconscious. And the most common reaction I have to these arguments is people say, I've always thought that, but I didn't know how to say it. That's the job of the writer, come up with some language. And the alternate sentence is that they'd never thought of this, but it sounds right to them. Very interesting. Those are the two most common reactions from hundreds and hundreds of people as I moved around the country. In other words, these arguments, these concepts, these philosophical concepts which come from here, sound to Canadians like Canadians. They sound like us. They resemble the way we really are or the way we really want to be. What I'm talking about, in a sense, is a new language built out of an old language to talk about ourselves, a language which comes from here and reflects here. But this can only work if Aboriginal peoples are at the center of the Canadian reality and if new Canadians are there in conversation with them. To which I would add, how lucky we are, because the Aboriginal people are making a remarkable comeback in numbers, in leadership, and in a highly modern expression of their ideas, which are the philosophical roots of this country. The return in force of the Aboriginal peoples means that Canada is getting a second chance to get it right. Very few countries are offered such a second chance. We should embrace it. We should embrace it with enthusiasm. Thank you very much.
On this episode of Ideas, the 2009 Laurier Institution UBC Multiculturalism Lecture by John Ralston Saul. John Ralston Saul's most recent book is called A Fair Country, Telling Truths About Canada. Ideas recorded his talk in April at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts at the University of British Columbia. The Multiculturalism Lecture is co-sponsored by the Laurier Institution, the University of British Columbia, and CBC Radio 1. Production in Vancouver, Kathleen Flaherty and Chris Cutress. In Toronto, Dave Field and Bernie Lucht. To find out about upcoming Ideas programs and podcasts, sign up for our weekly online newsletter. Just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas. And follow the links. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Paul Kennedy. Stay tuned now for the hourly news on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite Radio 137.